So good evening, everybody. Tonight we're going to do the second half of this talk on intention. We're going to talk more around the practicing aspect of it. So the first 2 weeks was just really about the nature of intention, this idea of right intention, or it's often called right thought, which is the way I like to think of it, is right thought. But it's also called right aspiration and right resolve. And I think thinking of it in terms of right thought is going to be the most helpful for me to kind of share the way I'm pointing around working or practicing with right intention. And so we kind of looked at whether or not it had, we looked at it last week and it had three parts: renunciation, goodwill, or what I would call kindness, and harmlessness. So it seems important to me that we start with this understanding that right intention is connected to wisdom. It's right view and right intention that supports this idea that in this practice we can have a clear comprehension about the way things really are. We say that phrase all the time. We use that phrase, oh, I just want to see things as they really are. But actually seeing things as they really are kind of requires us to get a little bit more up close and connected to our thinking. And so that's what I want to kind of talk a little bit about tonight, about how to get up close and think about that. Buddha said, there's a quote here from Buddha that says, what we are today comes from our thoughts of yesterday, and our present thoughts build our life of tomorrow. Our life is a creation of our mind. If a man speaks or acts with, or a man or woman, a person, I'll just say, if a person speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering will follow them as the wheel of a cart follows the animal that draws that cart. If a person speaks or acts with a pure mind, joy follows them as does their shadow. So it's almost as if from everything I have read and practiced with around right intention, it seems to me that if we begin to pay attention to our thoughts around this practicing to see our intentions, that we can begin to see how to move our conduct into this conduct that's more in line with right intention rather than conduct that's aligned in greed, hatred, and delusion. So last time we talked a little bit about what Bhikkhu Bodhi called the substituting practice that the Buddha did by dividing his thoughts up and substituting his thoughts towards thoughts that were based in renunciation, goodwill, and non-harm. And so I got to thinking about this, and I want to call them like the engine of ignorance. There's like an engine. You know, if any vehicle moves, there's an engine to it. There's a working thing that turns and makes it work. And that engine is thought. That engine, whatever gets us to action, however we act, whatever's going to get us there, it's this engine that's being fueled by thought. And that thought is what I want to talk about. If our thoughts are the engine of our thoughts is based in ignorance, we're going to move a certain way. And if the engine of our thoughts is based in wisdom or based in right intention, we're going to move a different way. And so if we just begin to see that the engine of thinking is more important to pay attention to than where we're moving, because where we're moving is going to follow whatever our thinking is in the first place. Mahatma Gandhi came up with a quote that's similar to the Buddha's that I thought I'd put here. It says, carefully watch your thoughts, for they become your words. Manage and watch your words, for they become your actions. Consider and judge your actions, for they become your habits. Acknowledge and watch your habits, for they become your values. Understand and embrace your values, for they become your destiny. And in some respects, if we think about where all this begins, it begins at this place of thought. And we'd like to, I want to talk a little bit about how to begin to pay attention to our thoughts a little closer and see things that might be obscured if we only pay attention to our actions. But I want to take a step back and kind of put this conversation around this principle of Hiri and Otapa. Hiri is spelled H-I-R-I, and Otapa is O-T-T-A-P-A. So Buddha called these two principles bright guardians of the world. It's going to be a little rough because it's like karma. They are just steeped in all of this stuff. Because of the use of English, it's hard sometimes to talk about some of these Dharma principles because English is such a limiting language in its noun. So just to give you an understanding, Hiri is considered an innate shame. So you know, you hear that word shame and you automatically think that cannot be a good thing because shame is just steeped in all this negativity. That's the way we use it. But the shame that Hiri is pointing to is more connected to our own sense of self-respect than it is connected to unworthiness. It's a sense, it's like when I go into a grocery store, even though the clerks follow me around like I'm going to steal, I'm not going to steal. It doesn't really have anything to do with them following me around. It's my own innate sense of shame and self-respect that I'm not stealing from anybody. But if you say there's an innate shame, then you have to be careful not to get caught in the word shame, because the shame is more out of honor and out of self-respect. Same way with Otapa. Otapa is considered a moral dread. You see how difficult it is. See, it's this moral dread. But the dread comes from a not wanting to be caught in this, in the consequences or the result of wrongdoing. It's beginning to understand that it's not worth the consequence and the result of wrongdoing because of the inevitable karma that's going to come, and you don't know how long that's going to last. So there's this line that you're like not going to cross. There are things I will not do, not because the moral dread represents some heavy punishment upon us, that the world puts upon us, but it's more because there's a sense of danger in wrongdoing that it's our own honor that we are protecting. So this protecting honor on the external side and the protecting our sense of self-respect on the internal side becomes these two poles by which everything kind of moves in between. But just to help us see, I mean, these are bright guardians, but they're difficult because the way they're taught to people is that you have to imagine excrement on one end of a pole and a burning hot fire on the other end of the pole. So you don't want to touch one end because it's like, ah! And you don't want to touch the other end because it's like, oh! So this is like, we're trying to live our lives in between that sense of immediacy. But it doesn't necessarily equate in the way our Western English mind can think of as a guardian. But there's something about the absoluteness of these two poles that keep us in the middle somewhere. And it has to be, in my respect, it has to be big enough and felt enough that we can stay within these intentions for renunciation, goodwill, kindness, and non-harm. Because if they were just slightly, you know, just like a slight rub, we may slide right over those boundaries like we do with most of our boundaries. We just slide over them and make them convenient for ourselves. So these two, the way Buddha described them, was far more more like a gut check, so that you can feel that you're moving outside of a line here. You can see the danger of it. Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote this great article called The Guardians of the World, and he noted here that the Buddha's stress on the importance of hiri and otapa was based on a deep insight into the different potentialities of human nature. So our human nature, we can go either way. We can go towards ignorance, greed, hatred, and delusion. We can go towards greater intentions with goodwill, renunciation, and harmlessness. The Buddha, saw that the path to deliverance is in the struggle against the current. So our deliverance is in this struggle. That's why it's so important. That's why it's such a big gut check when you're in the middle of this. And that if we are to unfold the mind's capacity for wisdom, purity, and peace, then we need to keep the powder keg of the defilements under the watchful eye of diligent sentinels. That just seems so beautiful to me. That if we saw that gut check as sentinels that help us stay clear of danger, it's almost like, I noticed this with kids. So anybody that has kids, they were little, used to be this rule. You could run all the way to the edge of the sidewalk, but you could not keep going. So you can watch kids, parents are just kind of strolling down the street, and the kids on a full blast run all the way up to the edge of the sidewalk, and then they stop. All kids kind of do that. But there's a sentinel, almost like there's a guard there. They don't necessarily grasp that it's very dangerous to run out in the middle of the street, or the level of that danger is. But because of the absoluteness in which parents enforce this no moving past the edge of the sidewalk, then there is this sentinel that protects them, even though you're halfway up the block, kind of strolling, because we're not doing the running part. So that's what we're going to try to see, if we can hold our discussion around these practicing with renunciation, kindness, and harmlessness. We're going to hold it within the framework of hiri and otapa. See if I can help you see. Usually hiri and otapa, and Tim might talk about this, the same things when he talks about right conduct, but usually they're talked about around conduct. But the reason why I want to talk about them around intention is because I think intention is the forerunner to conduct. And if we begin to take these two sentinels and have them as our gut check around our intentions, then I think we can equally see their benefit that you'd have around conduct. So they're sort of like the Buddhist way of saying our conscience, the little angels that are sitting on our shoulders. So at the beginning of the month, I had this idea. When this talk came, I would just talk about renunciation and goodwill and harmlessness in more detail. Just give more detail, and that's how we're going to practice with it. We're going to practice that way. But then as I started contemplating this, I realized that if your mind is anything like my mind, if we had a talk about renunciation, I would say, oh, that sounds great. I'm going to try that. And I would not start trying that. I'd hit the door and I'd go about my business. And it would be something in the back of my mind that I would think about. But the actual application of it gets much harder. So we're not going to do that. We're going to go through the back door. It's more the subtle side of it, and talk about the ignorant side of what I think renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness. The other side, the shadow side of the three, and then see how maybe Hiri and Otapa can help us get aligned with it a little better. So to me, the shadow side, or the way to see our ignorant engine, this engine that's pushing us towards ignorance around renunciation, is control. This idea that we have to control everything. It is like a fake thing that the mind does. So it's we can be a little patient with ourselves, because the mind convinces us that we actually have control over things. And we think we can control things. And that, therein lies our edge. Because we think we can control things, we start trying and making life in such a way that we can control it, thinking that that control is going to support us. And the reason why I think, even though I know I talk about this all the time, just like it's the running commentary, the reason why we think we can control things is because of this need to move towards the pleasant, to move towards the pleasing and the comfortable and the thing that I like. This moving towards that, it has a tremendous influence on how we see things, because we are convinced that that which is pleasing, that which is comfortable, that which is beautiful, nice, and lovely is right. And everything that is not pleasing, not beautiful, not lovely, not comfortable is wrong. So you can see that because that mind state exists, we are pulled towards trying to control everything to be nice and pleasing and right. But here is the rub. Because the mind makes up what it thinks is pleasing, comfortable, and right. It makes it up. It's not us making it up. It's our thinking. Things like pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, those feeling tones are not real. They're thoughts that are just grabbed by the mind. And the mind grabs that either by way of our history, our culture, our family, tradition, whatever, some great movie we saw in the past, and now we want to be like that superhero, and so now it thinks these things are right. And so we're leaning into thinking something is right, but that thinking is based on thought. It's based on a made-up concept from the mind. So Shanti Deva says, it's not possible to control all external events. But if I simply control my mind, what need is there to control other things? So one way to think of renunciation is this idea that we begin to put some restraints on the mind's attachment, tags, labels to everything as good or bad, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. We can't so much take away the mind's labeling capacity. That just happens naturally. It doesn't have anything to do with us. What we can do is stop following every single thing that the mind says. Stop trying to make life good, perfect, pleasing, lovely, nice. It's not easy to do this, though, because it doesn't feel good. It feels like if we just did it this way, everything would be nice. If I just had this thing happen, everything would be nice. Then I would be happy, everything would be good. So the beginning to think about control is a way to notice when we are rubbing up against this. It's sort of like when we start feeling the tension that we might be losing control of something, or we might not get our way, or this need to make it the way we want to make it so it'll be right, so we'll feel good. That's like the guardian. That's sort of what Hiri and Otapa do. They come up and show us where we are trying to impose our own kind of control on a situation. It's as if they are the way we can feel into this idea that we're following the mind's story or narrative about something. So I know as you sit there, you think, because this is what I was thinking, but wait a minute, surely there's some situations where I should have some control. And I thought about things like, you know, with my kids, putting all these controls into place so that they wouldn't, you know, get in danger and basically just do what I want so I don't have to have a lot of arguing about it. But those controls are what Hiri and Otapa do for us. If we could, as hard as it might seem to say this, but begin to parent ourselves around this idea that we have to have things our way, so we could begin to see that if I'm trying to have something my way, that in and of itself is where renunciation needs to show up. Renunciation, that restraint, is what's going to help us begin to loosen up a little bit and let things be as they are. In fact, it actually helps us kind of just be in the stream of the way life is. So the second engine, this goodwill, the shadow side of that, I think, is turning away. I think there's a way in which what we call reactivity is a turning away. It's an anger, aversion, a turning away from whatever is. And that turning away is our sign that we have moved away from kindness and or goodwill and have moved into the danger zone. It's another one of those tricks of the mind. Because the mind can equally, in our greed, convince us that things that are good are what we should get. It also, in our hatred, convinces us that there are enemies out there, bad out there. We don't want that. And so we turn away from whatever it is that we don't like in this kind of reactive way. The difficulty with this is we can't we don't have a mind. At least, I don't think, this is my opinion, but I don't think we have a mind that can conjure up the kind of kindness and goodwill that the Dhamma asks of us. I think we can feel into it in the body, but we cannot think of it in the mind. His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama, has this quote that says, faced with a problem, when we're faced with a problem, then try to remain humble while keeping a sincere attitude and think about the right solution. No doubt, some people will try to take advantage of your attitude. If your calm seems to encourage unfair aggression, be firm but be compassionate. If it turns out to be necessary for you to prove your point by severe countermeasures, do so without resentment or bad intentions. I don't think I ever heard a teacher talk about basically anger in a way that just kept framing the energy of anger as just being a natural part of life, but the aggression that comes over the top of anger as being the bigger problem. And so that's what I think Kiri and Otapa kind of help us with. I want to share a little bit of a story. I have to say it because it was so upsetting that, whenever things really just sometimes I think things happen because my mind is on it for preparing for a Dhamma talk. But so last night when I left the beginning class, turned on my phone and looked at my little Facebook. Don't have a lot of friends, but I have enough people that I know, Dhamma teachers and stuff like that. And this teacher posted this article that the headline alone upset me to no end. I never read the article. I don't even have a clue if the article is righteous or what, but the headline alone just floored me. It just took away something. And I was sitting on the train and I'm so upset I can't even function. But what's happening is in my mind is this level of rage and anger. And I remember what caught me was when I got off the train and I was walking and this woman looks at me and smiles. And I just looked back at her probably like, you know, I was using some cuss words at that point, like, don't even look at me! Don't look at me! But I saw her face shift from this smile to this kind of, oh, okay, I won't smile. That kind of thing. Like it's her fault I'm mad. She didn't have anything to do with it. And something about that moment, I was like, oh, I got to get home. I got to sit down. I got to calm down. Try to catch myself around this. I can't even tell you what the article was about. I can't even tell you what the headline was about because it's too upsetting. And we're too open having sat for 40 minutes, so I can't say, but I'm just telling you, it was unbelievably difficult. And so I go home and I'm trying to sit, and at first, all I could hear was all this raging, yelling, screaming at everybody because I was so mad. And after a bit of just constantly coming back to my breath, trying to get this centering, this image, that image over there of Kuan Yin, it's called the Royal Ease, came to mind. And I had this moment when I felt like, oh, that's why it's called the Royal Ease. You know, it's called Royal Ease because she's sitting there in this chair, but she is the Buddha of compassion. And so she's sitting in this chair, but she's about ready to jump up and go do whatever she needs to do. So there's this, it's like this ease, and she's steady, but she can get up any minute. And I remembered that picture and I sat there thinking, oh, that's what I need. I need royal ease. I need to have some compassion and this kindness, but trust that if in a moment I needed to get up and do something, I would. But reading some passing headline of an article that happened somewhere, who knows, I'm all upset and there's nothing I can do. I can't fix it, I can't change it, I can't work on it. So instead, I have to trust in the practice and this royal ease. What helped me get to that place was the Hiri and Otapa, these guardians that helped me feel how angry I was, hear these thoughts, hear all the things that I was saying in my mind. We have to be able to feel that reactivity, feel that rage, feel that anger, and not hate ourselves because it showed up. Who knows why it showed up? It just showed up out of the blue because I read this headline. I read some words, and all of a sudden the mind is off on this tirade. But if we're not comfortable, if we don't trust that we have these guardians that will help us solidify our deeper intentions, then we can get caught in the aversion and we're gone off with it. But instead, seeing that woman's face, feeling and hearing the thoughts that were going on in my head, and this basic kind of guardians that says, I'm not gonna get caught in all that. I'm gonna have to find a way to hold that energy without it being connected to this deeper enemy rage anger. It's that I think His Holiness is talking about, trying to find a way to hold this energy without losing it. Martine Batchelor said, an act of meditation is actually an act of faith. Of faith in your spirit, in your own potential. Faith is the basis of meditation, not of faith in something outside of you, but a metaphysical Buddha, not a faith in something outside of you, like a metaphysical Buddha, an unattainable idea, or someone else's world. The faith is in yourself, in your own Buddha nature, that you too can be a Buddha, an awakened being that lives and responds in a wise, creative, and compassionate way. So in some respects, what I think Hiri and Otapa point to in working with this kindness is it points towards our practice. When we start feeling ourselves getting off balance, getting more reactive, getting more caught up in things that there's a back of our mind, like Hiri is saying, you got more self-respect than that. You shouldn't be acting like that. You know this, like, what are you doing? That kind of talking that's going on in the back of our mind is a sign we need to go to the cushion. We need to go to practice and we need to find a centering place in the midst of all of this craziness that's swirling around us. Because we cannot stop all that craziness from swirling around us. But we can find the center that enables us to, in the midst of that, still stay true to this kinder nature and wait in this kind of royal ease until there's an opportunity to respond in a way that supports us. Otherwise, we just keep getting bombarded and we keep letting the thoughts control us and send us in all these other directions. So anyway, when I sat there, I could find this kindness. I could find this compassion for the level of suffering everybody had to be going through. And it's a lot of suffering on both sides. And everybody had to be suffering through this. And I could find a way to be with the compassion of that suffering and not have to make somebody an enemy and somebody a good guy, the enemy and victim. And this is not easy for us because all of my movies are based in some hero overthrowing some tyrannical other person. So this is like shifting everything that I can believe in to begin to have compassion for this idea that all the beings in that story, if it were true, all of them deserve some compassion, or I can have compassion for all of them. So the last one is towards this, the engine of ignorance that is, that we get trapped in around harmlessness is expectations. And at first, it might not seem like it's connected to expectations, but the expectation part that it's connected to is that we get so focused on the future or the past or our expectations, our own personal agendas, we can't see anything else. We can't see what's actually going on in the rest of the world. So it's the getting lost that happens that cause us to kind of lose our way. The lawyer in me is used to being caught in entangled debate all the time. And so I'm just used to talking that way. I'm used to being that way. I did it for 25 years. I went to law school to train me to never forget how to argue and talk that way. But when you're talking about teaching Dhamma, it is a completely different way of talking. It's a completely different way of being. Every time I try to give a talk, I really want to say, you have to do this, and you better do this, and this is what I'm telling you. This is the way it is. There's all that energy that's like this forceful kind of telling people what to do. But at the same time, I'm learning more and more and more that it isn't really like that at all. There is no one way to do it. There's no right way to do it. There's no my way to do it. It's sort of like creating the space for everybody in this room, as many as there are, to figure out on their own how they want to do it, how they want to see these things. So it's a completely different way of listening, talking, and just relating. So I was talking to Philip Moffitt, who's my mentor for the teacher training, and we came up with this idea that I had to watch entanglement. Feel into entanglement. It's like my hairy otapa edges. Feel into it. So I came up with this, I don't know if I told you guys this, I don't think so, but I came up with this far out concept when I went to the teacher training, something that nobody would believe in. And of course, I got to argue this point when I get there. And everybody, all the trainees were all like, stop talking about that, Tori, that's stupid. But I needed to talk to people so I could see what happens in a relatively harmless, jovial situation. But I could see what happens when I get entangled. And I was amazed. What happens is I don't see people. Even though I'm sitting at a table, I notice I could be sitting at a table and there's all these people around and we're all kind of talking. The minute I start talking and trying to prove this point, I can't see anybody else. I'd have to literally tell myself, Tuareg, please notice that there are people sitting at the table. Can you see so-and-so? Can you see so-and-so? Can you see? Otherwise, it's like everything disappears and it's only me and my point. And that's sort of, I don't know if that's necessarily what happens to everybody, but it's along the same line of where harmlessness, where harm comes from. We don't see anybody, and we don't see the effect of what we're doing. So when you start noticing things like expectations, disappointments, this manipulative way that we're trying to get this happening this way, my agenda, We want to see if we can notice our own. Can we notice that we don't see anybody else? Can we wake up to the present moment instead of being lost in the past, the future, and our judgment? Can we wake up to the present moment? That's what Hiri and Otapa kind of help us do. They kind of help us see that we're kind of lost. I think harmlessness interrupts the engine of ignorance around expectations. So if we watch for that, harmlessness can interrupt that. We can substitute that. Goodwill or kindness interrupts that reactivity of negativity, that the anger and the negativity in the world. Kindness, we can substitute it, and it disrupts that. And renunciation disrupts or interrupts our ability to always need to control everything. So we're really trying to substitute these three intentions for the thinking that protects us and keeps us trapped in the greed, hatred, and delusion. So I think I'm going to end with this quote from Mother Teresa. It's a pretty famous quote, so you may have heard it, but I think it just, maybe it just feels like this is what the Dhamma is trying to tell us to do. It says, if you are kind, people may accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are successful, you will win some false friends and some true enemies. Succeed anyway. If you are honest and frank, people may try to cheat you. Be honest anyway. When you spend years building, what you spend years building, someone could destroy overnight. Build anyway. If you find serenity and happiness, they may be jealous of you. Be happy anyway. The good you do today will often be forgotten tomorrow, but do good anyway. Give the world the best you have, and it may never be enough, but give your best anyway. So let's take a moment to sit quietly and let the words float off into the ether somewhere. So we can take some questions if people have any. Or comments is fine also. Or silence, it's fine too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess I'm trying to get my head around the Hiri and Otapa. I guess especially when you're kind of in the heat of things, when you're open here, I guess how, other than just sitting, I guess how are ways to really become more aware of it?
So the question is kind of wrapping our heads around Hiri and Otapa, when you're in the heat of some, I'm assuming anger or reactivity, what is it that you do? And in, you know, maybe sitting just doesn't seem like it's going to be enough for it. And that's it right there, because there is nothing else. The reason why sitting is the reason why to me it is the it's the substitution for the anger and the thoughts that are driven by aversion, is that it is the only way for us to find kindness, the level of kindness that we need in order to love the whole world. Because our thinking is naturally going to divide things into the good people and the bad people, the right way to do it, the wrong way to do it, good and evil. It automatically divides things into this way. And as long as we have this thinking that there is a good and an evil and a right and a wrong, we are inevitably going to be trapped by reactivity. We can't avoid it because we are always going to be reactive around the things that we think are wrong, evil, shouldn't be. But it is. But this dedication to practice, what ends up happening is, it's not like I did not have a bout of rage last night. It's not like I don't have anger anymore. Everything's all smooth. It's all good. It's not like that. I was as rageful last night as I have been in years. It's been years since I was that upset. But I couldn't even get away from it. The thoughts were just bombarding me. I can't even believe that I was thinking of doing damage to people at the level I was thinking. So the only way I can get out of that is I'm going to have to find a way to connect to a deeper level of kindness, because I cannot right the wrong that was done. Do you see? The only thing that there is connecting to a deeper level of kindness so that I then can get up in the morning and still be good with the world. That's what the Hiriyan Otapa is what helps us see how rageful we are, how angry and reactive we are, so we could begin to see that that rage and anger is not going to lead us to some kind of better end. It's just going to keep us trapped in the rage and anger. So the energy that comes with anger, I have really come to know, it's not the energy, that power that comes, that's the problem. It's the enemy, aversive thinking that comes with it, that's the problem. So if you can calm that aversive thinking into this act of being kind or compassion, then you can use the energy to actually do something that's productive. That's what I think His Holiness is saying. It's not the energy, because we tend to associate the anger and the energy together, but really the energy is the same energy that Kuan Yin is going to need to jump up off of that seat and go help somebody. It's the same degree of energy, but it's not based in resentment and bitterness and aversion. It's based in a sense of kindness and a sense of compassion and care for the suffering. And so it's the only way to get that understanding when we hear some of the cruelty that's going on in the world, it's got to be from practice. It's not going to come from thinking to ourselves, how do I work on this? So basically I'm saying it's just in the act of staying with the practice and practicing and practicing and practicing. And after a while, our reactivity naturally begins to fade and fade, because we begin to replace that reactivity with this level of kindness. In fact, I can remember many sits of calling to mind something I was angry with, just so I could practice feeling anger and settling back in the body. So that's getting a sense of being with that reactivity without hating ourselves or getting stuck in it or thinking I shouldn't be this way. Instead, it's just having a healthy appreciation for the fact that we get reactive and we get angry and we have aversion, and we're just going to watch it and see what it actually does and how it leads, and then where does this kindness and compassion, what happens when we think on that? That was a little shocking to me. So the question is that, you know, about my practice working with entanglement and beginning to see that I don't see people, and how do I, if I can talk a little bit more and how to work with that. So I think it starts like with Eric's question. It starts with a willingness to feel entanglement. We have to know that we're being entangled. And that feeling of entanglement doesn't feel good. It feels uncomfortable, like something's wrong. Like we should fix this. If we just do it my way, it's going to work. I mean, that's what the mind is saying. It doesn't come across that way. It comes across like, let me say it a different way. Because clearly if I say it now the 19th time, you're going to understand that I'm really the one, this is the way we should do it. So there's that feeling. We have to learn to be comfortable with that feeling. And that's what I mean by it doesn't feel comfortable, these feelings of unpleasantness. They feel like something's wrong and we should smooth it all out, make it all peaceful and good. But instead, it starts with a willingness to say, okay, I get entangled. I get caught up in stuff. Can I just stay with this felt sense of entanglement and investigate that? What does it feel like when I'm entangled? What's happening? And you can begin to see, that's how I could see the mind not seeing people, is because I had to be willing to be still enough with feeling entangled so that I could see, oh, that's why I'm entangled. Because I'm actually arguing with myself. I'm not arguing with anybody else. I'm just arguing with myself. It's like a monologue. I'm just on the stage saying what I need to say. Clearly, everybody's going to hear me. So when you can stay and see that, you will see the way out. You will see the response in your ability to stay with the uncomfortable. Because there's something about being quiet with the uncomfortable that allows the natural response. It really is compassion. When we stay with the uncomfortable and we are willing to see it, what arises is compassion. And compassion is the natural response to suffering. So when I stayed there and I saw that I don't see anybody, I really just have a mirror of myself in front, and I'm talking to myself with this monologue. So I don't see that everybody else is trying to say something. I'm just talking. I can't even see that somebody else might have a point. I just am talking to myself in the mirror. And when I can see that, I can have some compassion and say, oh my God, where you don't see anybody. So then there's this little otapa that says, Can you see people? Tori, do you see that person? Do you see this person? And then I can keep coming back to trying to see. That's why but it starts with a willingness to be in the thick of something difficult without making that difficult somehow get smoothed over. Because as soon as we smooth over the difficulty, then we don't even know. It's going to come back, and we don't know how it came. We don't know where it comes from, what happens, what brought that on. We don't know. We have to stay with the difficult and be with it. And compassion kind of comes to help us in our willingness to be with this difficult. With kindness, then we can begin to see a response that helps us out of it, helps us through it. And actually, when I started seeing people were saying some great things. I can't believe I didn't listen to anybody at first. So people were saying things that really made a lot of sense, and the conversation got more reasonable and real, and it's not so contentious because I'm not just having a monologue with myself. So that's really how we begin to see it. It starts with staying with the difficulty. And then that compassion that comes to help us stay, that's what helps us see what's the best response. And you'll see it. It could be just when you start feeling this energy, that's your hiri otapa, that's your guardian that says, oh, I'm about ready to tip over into something. And that alone begins to be enough. So it's just really the staying with it. That's the start of it. Yeah.
You were talking about feeling this need, the strong need to control things, or being on top of how things are going, and the shadow side of that being turning away. Can you say a little more about that? How that would feel like?
The need to control is the shadow for wanting things to be good, pleasant, and let me just say, because I learned that you can't hear any of these questions on the thing. So the question was, I was talking about this need to control, and that the shadow is the turning away, and wanted me to explain a little bit more about it. But I was saying that need to control is the shadow side to greed. It's the wanting everything to be pleasant, pleasing, and nice. And so we control everything to try to make things nice, to try to make my life smooth. I don't want the boat to be rocking. I want everything to be nice, easy going, smooth. So as soon as something difficult comes, we try to hurry up and smooth that out so it's all good, all nice, all pleasing, because the mind thinks pleasing, all of that is good. So in our efforts to try to control, we actually end up creating all this suffering for ourselves and everyone else. The antidote or the remedy for that control and greed is renunciation. In the turning away, it's more that we turn away rather than apply kindness, that the mind creates enemies, aversion, a don't like. It's the opposite. So instead of being with something that we're averse to, we turn away from that. And by turning away from it, we are basically, you know, I don't want that, pushing that away. And that pushing away is in effect creating this separation. In Dhamma, all things are held in together. One thing. So this, in order to hold everything, even the stuff we don't like, we got to do that with kindness. So we have to begin to apply some kindness into the situation so we can bring things together as one. And that turning away, we can see it when we notice our reactivity. When we're very reactive, we're not with something, we're really turning away from it, pushing it away, trying to get it to go away. So the control is so we can have a good life, make it happy and beautiful. The reactivity is trying to get rid of all the stuff that we don't like. And to me, the application or the substitution of our averse thoughts with kindness is the way to begin to shift that reactivity. And the substitution of this need to control with just restraint and let life be as it is the way that we begin to shift the suffering around trying to control. Yeah.
It all makes so much sense. And then I think of where I have strong reactivity, say, with someone who's clearly doing harm, is clearly making poor decisions. I think about the president. How do you take Donald Trump and apply this? I know I should.
So the question is, you know, even though we hear all these things, it sounds great, but then when we think about some people that are clearly doing bad stuff and wrong, how do we apply it? Like, if we think Donald Trump's behavior is just off the chain, if we think that, then how do you hold this and apply it? I think this is why I think kindness is so important, why practice is so important. Because if I had the ability to control the behavior from a lot of the government agencies at this point, I would do that. All of us would. We would do it. It would be nothing. We would just do it. But the problem is that we can't do it. So we can feel the pain that comes out of this. And everything in us feels like there's got to be something more than just kindness. It's got to be. And there does have to be this powerful energy to move us. So we do have to move and do something. But if we are moving out of aversion, then no matter how much we want to believe we are on the side of righteousness and good, we are going to cause harm. I mean, I hate to say it, but I think part of what we're feeling is the disrespect and movement of forcing people to live the way that we wanted people to live for so long without ever really seeing. And so we're like feeling the same rage that many of the people I used to work with had when other presidents were in office. So some of this is beginning to appreciate that this idea that somehow we're going to find the right way to be is the good people and the bad people, it's just like watching a superhero movie. I'm beginning to see this. I can't even believe I'm saying this because I so love superheroes. And yet, I'm beginning to think that those superhero movies are killing me. I keep waiting for some superhero to come and fix all this mess. But there was a nun at a retreat I went to several years ago who, it was during Bush's time, and during the question and answer period, people kept asking her, well, what do we do? What should we do right now? What should we do? Because, you know, to change the world. And she said, practice. And I just remember thinking to myself, what? There's no way practice is going to help anything. We need something. We need you to be more powerful. Say something bigger. Like, let's get out in the streets and start marching or something. And there is a place for getting out in the streets. And as soon as people are ready to get out in the streets, I'm out there too. But what I needed last night was practice. Can you see that? I needed to be able to find my center in a situation where I had scattered out into the winds. And so if we don't have the ability to find center, then we get scattered, we get overwhelmed, and we cannot get up the next morning and actually move and do something if we need to. So what you're trying to do, if you can't get to the place of holding Donald Trump on the same level as Mother Teresa, you gotta read Thich Nhat Hanh's poem. I mean, he's like the slave and he's the pirate. He's the girl that gets raped and he's the person that's doing the raping, right? So if you can't hold that kind of a concept, then at the very least, can you hold a level of kindness that you can get up in the morning and not be overwhelmed by the cruelty in the world? That I can get up in the morning and I can still do what's right for the world. It's strange because back in 2007, when I was at that monastic retreat, the nun said what she said. I didn't think practice was going to do nothing. But when I got off the train last night, I didn't want to do anything else. I needed to go home and sit quietly. Don't talk to me. Just let me sit down before I hurt somebody. Let me just be still a moment. So that's what we're really looking towards. That's why practice helps us, even with aversion. Okay, so we've got to leave it there. I'm all worked up. I can feel it. I can feel it. I'm all back where I was. I have to go home and sit again. Thank God for the practice memo. So, who is doing announcements?